Today's April 8th. Back in our class on the Torah portions they never told us about, we're in the book of Numbers, as I had just said. We're going to begin in chapter 20, basically with an overview. We're going to look at chapter 20 and 21. We're not going to do all the matters there. I think that next week we'll go back. After the overview of today, next week we'll go back to chapter 20 and deal with one or two issues there, 20 and 21. So the first thing I want to do is remind us where we are, not physically in the JCC, but where we are in the book of Numbers, what's been happening for the past 40 years. And this is a review that you probably heard from Gail and you probably heard it from me 3 months ago. Always remember where we are as the chronology progresses in the book of Numbers. And as usual, I'm just following the sheets that I prepared. So remember that the Israelites left Egypt a long time ago in chapter 12 of the book of Exodus. And that was, of course, just 2 weeks ago and a few thousand years ago, 2 weeks ago. And they made it within 50 days to Mount Sinai in the Sinai Desert. And there they spent approximately a year over the Sinai Desert. They had the epiphany from God, and they had the sin of the golden calf. They had Moses coming up and down the mountain, going back and forth to God to ask for forgiveness. He was there, according to tradition, 120 days. He came down on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, 120 days after the holiday of Shavuot that celebrates the epiphany on Mount Sinai. And altogether, God forgave the Jewish people after 120 days of Moses beseeching. And when he comes down, he brings the commandment to build the tabernacle. They spend another 6, 7, 8 months building the tabernacle. They finish building the tabernacle on the first day of Nisan, the month of Nisan, which means it's a year after they left Egypt. And then the preparations begin for the journey into the desert. Those preparations begin, as you remember, at the beginning of the book of Numbers, which opens in the first month of the second year after leaving Egypt. And the beginning of the book, the first 10, 11 chapters, was all about the preparation for the move through the desert. And then about chapter 12, 13, we begin the move into the desert. And what we're told in the book of Numbers about the move through the desert, the journey through the desert, is about one complaint after another, one revolt after the other. And on the sheet, I just listed the revolts that we've all seen when we were here in October, November, December. So they begin the journey from the encampment at Mount Sinai, as I wrote here, on the 20th day of the second month of the second year. That's when they begin actually moving. And there's the complaint at Taverah, which we saw. It's only 3 or 4 verses, and it says they were punished by a fire that came forth and consumed many of the people. And later there was the complaint at Kivrot HaTavarah, the lack of meat. That's when they're given the slav, the quail from heaven, as you probably remember. Then there's the complaint of Aaron and Miriam against Moshe. Just remember, and that's chapter 12, which means they started their journey actually in chapter 8, right? And then there's the spies of the tourists. That's chapters 13 and 14. And you remember that that ends up with a big revolt against God, that the people follow the advice of the spies and don't want to go into the land of Israel. And they're punished by saying that another 39, 40 years you have to spend in the desert. And then there's the Mapilim, which you might not remember. That's when, right after they're told by God, you can't enter the land, they say, we changed our mind, we want to go. But God says, it's too late. I said no. You're already being punished. They try to go into land by force, and they're defeated by the Canaanites. That's the Mapilim. Afterwards, we saw the stick gatherer, and I put that in brackets because that's not really a revolt. That's just one person who's gathering sticks on Shabbat, and he's punished for it. And then there's Korach's rebellion. And number 8 is the quarrel of people with Moshe at Mei Merivah. Mei Merivah, that means the waters of contention. And that is chapter 20. That's where Moses and Aaron are told that you sinned, you can't go into the land of Israel. That's a really synopsis of the chronology of where we are and the geography of where we are. And now, be in the sheet, just a short second introduction to see the broad picture. So let's look at the first verse of chapter 20. Yeah?
The word you're using, revolt.
Revolt.
Can you spell that?
R-E-V-O-L-T.
Okay.
Yeah, I meant revolt.
Okay.
Complaint, rebellion against God and Moses. So in chapter 20 of the book of Numbers, it says the following. The Israelites arrived in a body at the wilderness of Tzin on the first new moon, and the people stayed at Kadesh. I want to try and understand, that's an important verse. It's a landmark verse, actually. So the first thing we can say about it... Good evening. Good to see you. My translation says the first new moon. So other translations might not say that. I'm not sure. Anyone have a different translation?
On the first month.
The first month. So there really is a difference. If the word means the first month, then we don't know the date. If it's the first new moon, we mean the first day of the first month of the year. So it's a little bit more specific to translate it as the first new moon. The Hebrew says, the Chodesh HaRishon, the first month. But the word Chodesh means not only month, but also moon. So it could be the moon, when the moon appears in the first month, which means it's the first day of the first month. Now why is it important? It's important because remember that if it's the beginning of the first month, well, that's the beginning of the first month of the Jewish calendar. If important things are going to happen and things are set up properly, if the stars are aligned, you'd expect that important things are going to happen on the first of the year. In other words, it's New Year's. And today we celebrate Rosh Hashanah as New Year's, but really in the Jewish calendar, Nisan is the first month, and the beginning of Nisan is the first of Nisan. So after going through the desert and having the string of complaints over the course of many years, they finally get to some place on the first day of a new year. And where is this place? It is Tzin Kadesh. It's not clear from the verse. What's the relationship between Tzin and Kadesh? Right? It says they arrived to the wilderness of Tzin at this certain time, and the people stayed at Kadesh. So it could be that Kadesh and Tzin are the same thing. It could be that Tzin is the region, the wilderness of Tzin, and Kadesh is an oasis or a city within that place. I have a map that I photocopied, not only on the board, but I photocopied one on the sheets. And it shows there the wilderness of Tzin, and it shows a place called Kadesh Barnea, which is probably the long form of the place they arrived, Kadesh. Kadesh probably is Kadesh Barnea. And if you look on the map where it is, it's about 60 kilometers to the southeast of Beersheba, just to get your bearings. Does everyone see the place? Mm-hmm. Todd, you're looking for it.
Yeah, I need to look on hers. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep,
that's it. So we know where they are. Now, what else do we want to say about that? Well, let's look up some sources to figure out more about the significance of this place Tzin, and if it's the same as Kadesh, or it's a region that Kadesh is part of. So I'm looking on my sheet in B2A, which says to see Numbers 33:36. So we're going to look at Numbers 33:36 to try and get our bearings, our geographical and our chronological bearings. 33:36. 33:36 is in, I guess you should say, a very boring Torah portion. It says they went from X to Y and Y to Z and Z to A and A to B and B to C. It's all the list of the stations, the way stations in the journey in the desert. And the list begins in verse 5. Israel set up from Ramses and camped at Sukkot, and it says all the different stations that they camped in the desert until you get to verse 36, where it says, they set out from Etzion Gaver and encamped in the wilderness of Tzin, that is Kadesh. So here it looks like Tzin and Kadesh are the same thing, and you notice that it's really at the end of the list. If you look further, the list doesn't go any further. So in other words, we're finished. We've gone through about 36 different stations in the desert. We're finally just about on the border of the land of Israel. Because if you go back to the map, it looks like this place, Tzin, Kadesh, is really the southern border of Israel, between Israel, land of Canaan, and the Sinai Desert. Now, the 60 kilometers to the north, you're in Beersheba. That's certainly Israel already. And just to notice where they came from, when they came to Tzin, which is Kadesh, they came from Etzion Gaver. Etzion Gaver is today Eilat. As far as we know, if you want to look on the map again, on the last page of this handout, they wrote there Etzion Gaver, Etzion Geber, they wrote, right by Eilat. And there's an arrow that shows the traveling from that area up to Kadesh Barnea going northwest. See where I am?
Right.
Now remember, we're not certain about most of the place names here. It's an approximation. Very few are certain. It's happened a long time ago, these events. If you want to coordinate it with the modern Israeli map, well, here's Eilat down here, and here's Beersheba, so Kadesh would be right about here. Right about here, which is the around the 1948 armistice line. And actually, and the present border between Israel and Egypt, right around here is Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh. Okay. Let's see another verse again to get our chronological geographical bearings. I'm looking at Numbers 13, 21, and 26. So I'm going to the book of Numbers, I'm going backwards to chapter 13. This is the chapter that deals with the spies, the tourists. Numbers 13:21. I'm reading Numbers 13:21, talking about the scouts, the spies, the tourists. They went up and scouted the land from the wilderness of Tzin to Rehov at Levo Hamat. So it looks like it's saying they set out from the wilderness of Tzin. In other words, that's where the Israelites were encamped when the spies were sent out. Remember, the spies were sent out in the second year after leaving Egypt, right at the beginning of our journeys. They're at Mount Sinai. They traveled from Sinai north to Tzin, the border of the land of Israel, border of Canaan. From then they sent out the spies. And of course, we know that things didn't work out too well. Let's look at verse 26. In the same chapter we're looking at right now, we read 21, now reading 26. 26 says, at the end of 40 days they returned from scouting the land, they went straight to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israel community at Kadesh. So when they went forth, it says they went forth from Tzin. When they came back, it says they came back to Kadesh, indicating again that these two places are kind of synonymous. I know the next few words says the wilderness of Paran. How does that fit in? Another question. But it looks like, again, that Tzin and Kadesh are pretty synonymous. One more verse. We're looking now at Numbers 33, verse 4. Skipping to Numbers 34, I should have said. Numbers 34, verse 4. Numbers 34, verse 4. What we're looking at now is a chapter that deals with the boundaries of the land of Canaan. Chapter 34, verse 4, the boundaries of the north, south, east, and west. And we find the following concerning the southern boundary of the land of Israel. Verse 4 of chapter 34, your boundary, the Briut, shall then turn to pass south at the ascent of Akrabim and continue to Tzin, and its limit shall be south of Kadesh Barnea, etc. So what we're talking about now is the southern boundary of the land of Canaan is just south of Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh Barnea again is Kadesh. So we've learned again that Kadesh Barnea, Kadesh, is the southern boundary of the land of Canaan, separating between the Sinai Desert and what's called the land of Canaan. To put all this together, whether this dry, boring chronology and geography, we have the following. The Israelites left Egypt, spent a year approximately at Mount Sinai, began their journey to the land of Canaan, and made it to this place called Kadesh, which is the boundary of Canaan. And then they sent the spies to figure out how to conquer it. The whole thing went bad, and God punished them for 39 or 40 years of wandering the desert. They wandered in the desert, and when they finished their time, they came back to the exact same spot they were at 39 years ago. Why do that same spot? Because it's take two. We're trying again. So when the Torah tells us, in the verse we read that I began with 10 minutes ago, in chapter 20 of the book of Numbers, that they reached the wilderness of Tzin, Kadesh, on the first day of the first month, what it means is they've now come back to point zero. The wandering, the desert is finished. We're ready to start again to try to enter the land of Israel. And that's why it's on the first day of the first month, because it's a new beginning. It's a new year. That's the story. Which means that we have now finished covering 40 years in the desert. Chapter 20 of the book of Numbers, the 40 years are over. And we're now entering the land of Israel. Okay? And as I said in the class I gave 2 weeks ago before Pesach that you guys didn't hear, things go wrong again. Because in chapter 20, that's when Moses and Aaron are told they can't enter the land because of their sin. In other words, it was the very last minute after all those 40 years that they were told, sorry, you can't go. But that we're not going to repeat. Okay, so now we know where we are. We know where we are, right? And I'd like to take something like 10 minutes now just to read chapter headings in chapters 20 and 21 to know what's going on there. And then we can go back and fill in the details. So I'm turning to chapter 20 of the book of Numbers. That's the one whose first verse we've been concentrating on. And I'm not even going to read at this point all of the words in chapter 20 and 21. I'm just going to give an overview. And perhaps we'll read a few words here and there. The overview is based on things I wrote on the sheet. The first thing I want to say, before we see all of the different events described here and the geographical place names, is that a lot is not clear. Archaeologists and historians and Bible scholars have been arguing, and they'll continue to argue, where is this place and when did this happen and how does it fit, and it doesn't seem to make sense. And I'm not a Bible scholar and I'm not an archaeologist, I'm not a historian, I don't claim to have any answers. We're going to try and find some type of deeper meaning in it, but I'm really not sure that I know myself the chronology and the geography. So after that disclaimer, let's look at material. So the first thing that happens here in chapter 20 is the people complain that they want water, and you know the story. God says, we'll take water out of a rock. Moses and Aaron hit the rock and they're punished for their insubordination. It's really not clear what they did wrong. Some say hitting the rock, some say getting angry, some say calling the people rebels. It really is not clear. But that's the punishment that Moses and Aaron are given. In verse 14, after that incident, it says, from Kadesh, Moses sent messengers to the king of Edom. Let's look at the map now, the map that I have on the sheets, and understand where Edom is in relationship to Kadesh. So if we're looking at the map, and we see there Kadesh, Kadesh Barnea, and we see Edom. Let's again coordinate that with the way things are today. So on the map of modern Israel, if here is Kadesh Barnea, Edom is in this whole area here to the east of what we'd call the Jordan Valley, the Arava. It's not, I shouldn't call it Jordan Valley. Jordan Valley is up high. The Arava, right? They left us down here. Now, something very strange is going on here. The Israelites are here. If you want to go from Kadesh Barnea to land of Israel, to Canaan, all you have to do is drive due north. Here you go, to Beersheba. Why are they sending messages to Edom? What's the relationship? What's the connection to Edom? That's a big question. For some reason, it looks like Moses knows that they want to enter the land of Canaan not by going due north, but for some reason they want to go around until they get to here, facing Jericho. Why? We really don't know why. It could be that Moses knows the first time they tried to go due north, it didn't work so well, so we'll try a different way. But the text doesn't tell us at all. There's a big, big gap in the text. But they're sending messages, they're asking Edom, can we pass through your land so we can go skirting the land of the Canaan and come up over here with my fingers. And this again is right facing Jericho. Jericho is on the west side of the Jordan, and they're going to be encamped on the east side in another few months. They're going to go this whole route in a short time of a few months. Okay, so let's go back to the text and my sheets. So, the text says that Moses sends messengers to Edom, and they twice refuse to let the Israelites pass until the Israelites decide to turn away. Let's look at the verse that says turn away. I'm looking at verse 21 of chapter 20. And we didn't read the whole story. We're just reading the last verse. So Edom would not let Israel cross their territory, and Israel turned away from them. Now those words turned away in Hebrew and English are ambiguous. Turned away to where? What did Moses decide to do? Okay, so we can't cross through this swath of territory. What are we going to do now? Does he decide to go due north in any case? Or does he try something else? It's not clear. It's not clear. Okay? So, let's read on. In the same chapter, we get to 22. Verse 22, it says, setting out from Kadesh, the Israelites arrived in a body at Mount Hor, and then it says there that that's where Aaron died. We're not going to talk about Aaron dying today. Perhaps we'll talk about it next week. Where is Mount Hor? We don't know. I mean, you could look at some maps and you'll see a suggestion. You look at a different map, it'll say someplace else. Again, I'm not an archaeologist. Then we get to chapter 21. When the Canaanite king of Arad, who dwelt in the Negev, learned that Israel was coming by the way of the Atarim, he engaged Israel in battle and took some of them captive. Well, we know where Arad is, right? Here's Arad. Here's Kadesh Barnea. Here's Arad. And again, you can look on the maps that I photocopied for you. I think that Arad is there. Can you see Arad? It's pretty near the top. Now, we know where Arad is. There are excavations there. We know where the city of Arad is. We have Tel Arad, the hill of Arad. It's clear. So what's going on? Again, Moses apparently wanted to take the people around the east. The Edomites didn't agree, so Moses turned aside. Where did he go? We don't know. But suddenly we have the Canaanites and Arad attacking the Israelites. So where are the Israelites? Well, it must be someplace around here. The Canaanites from Arad could have come down south to meet the advancing Israelites, to head them off at the pass. It's probably someplace around here that this battle is taking place. So it looks like, nothing is certain, but it looks like that Moses decided that if the Edom won't have us going through their territory, we're going to have to go north. And they went north, and they were met by the Canaanite army coming forth from Arad. That looks like what's happening. One more disclaimer, it's really not clear. So what happens in the Battle of Arad? So I'm going to go back to 21 and read, chapter 21. Verse 2, then Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, if you deliver this people into our hand, we will proscribe their towns. In other words, we won't take any booty. We'll just leave it sanctified, as it were. The Lord heeded Israel's plea and delivered up the Canaanites, and they and their cities were proscribed, so that place was called Horma. Okay. So the Israelites defeat the Canaanite army in Arad, or near Arad, probably south of Arad. Now, what would you expect Moses and the Israelites to do next if they just defeated? Of course, to go further north. And that's exactly the opposite of what the next verse says. They set out from Mount Hor, I'm reading verse 4, by where the Sea of Reeds, to skirt the land of Edom. What? I don't get it. It's really not clear. Now, the Sea of Reeds in Hebrew, Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds, we recognize that. But where is that? I mean, if you look at the map that I photocopied, again, we don't know where the Sea of Reeds is. I mean, the one that the Israelites went through when they left Egypt. Remember that, right? Back in the book of Exodus, when they left Egypt, they went the crossing of the Reed Sea, the Red Sea. That's probably, you see where my finger is? Migdol? It's probably around there. Although, who knows? It also could be here by Marah. But wherever it is, whether the Sea of Reeds, which isn't more, remember, than a three-day journey from where they were in Egyptian slavery, right? It's someplace here near the Nile Delta, either on the Mediterranean coast or down here by the this branch of the Red Sea, which is the beginning today of the Suez Canal. Wherever this Reed Sea is, it's nowhere near where the Israelites are now, near Arad. You with me? It's really hard to figure out what's going on. Now, what's the closest sea to where they are? Well, the closest sea is what's called today the Gulf of Eilat, the Gulf of Aqaba, which is what we call today the Red Sea, as opposed to the Reed Sea. So most of the commentators assume we're talking about the Red Sea. Again, it's the closest sea. Even though the words used are the same words used for the sea that's right near Egypt, that we were at 40 years ago. So this stuff is difficult, hard, not clear. But assuming that where they went now is to the... They went to Eilat for vacation. That's where they went, right? But the question is, why, if they just opened up the passageway into the land of Israel to go north by defeating the king of Arad, they should have gone north. But suddenly they go south, all the way down here. What they're trying to do is skirt Edom. Edom covers all this territory. Edom didn't let them through, so they're trying to get in down here and then go all the way around so they don't have to go to the territory of Edom. With me? So some things are clear and some things are not clear at all. So we have a question, why are they going south when they should have gone north? Okay. So now we're just going to go on, ask a few more questions before we go back and try and make some sense of this all. Let's read now chapter 21, verse 4. They set out from Mount Hor by way of the Sea of Reeds to skirt the land of Edom. But the people grew restive on the journey, and the people spoke against God and against Moshe. Why did you make us leave Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no bread and no water, and we have come to loathe this miserable food, meaning the manna. The Lord sent seraph serpents against the people. They bit the people, and many of the Israelites died. Etc. Another complaint, another revolt. Let's read on in verse 10. The Israelites marched on and camped at Ovot. We don't know where it is. And then it says, they set out from Ovot and camped at Iabarim in the wilderness bordering on Moab to the east. Moab to the east. So now we can understand something. Again, looking at the map that's in the photostats. So it looks like they went down to Eilat, and they made a big circle, leaving Edom on their left, on their to the west of them. And they started coming up with Moab now on their west side, on their
east side.
West side.
I thought
you
said east side.
Well, let me do it here. Right, here is Edom. Uh-huh. Here is Moab. Uh-huh. By the way, it says here Moab in Hebrew. So they're going all the way around in the desert with, on their west side, Edom and then Moab. That's what's happening.
They go to Moab is on the east, they're on the west side.
They go to the east, right, and okay. The peoples are on their, on the west side. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a big, how do you say?
That's a loop.
Loop, when they could have gone straight north, and we really don't know why. Really don't know why. Okay. We'll read that later. Let's read verse 21. Let's read verse 20. from Bamot to the valley that is in the country of Moab at the peak of Pisgah, overlooking the wasteland. Pisgah is a mountain right about here. They're all the way here. They've passed through the whole Dead Sea on their left, on their western side. They're right about here. And from this point, it says that they sent scouts to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through your country." So they want to continue going a little bit further north, and as the account says, the Amorites don't let them go. Amorites come out and attack, and the Israelites conquer all the towns of the Amorites. And then, let's just finish up this little story. Verse 31. So Israel occupied the land of the Amorites. Then Moses sent to spy out Yazer, and they captured its dependencies, disposed the Amorites who were there. They marched on and went up to the road to Bashan. Anyone know where Bashan is? Bashan is the southern Golan Heights. In other words, they have gone all the way to Syria. So according to this account, they've gone through the desert, they've captured the territory of the Amorites, Khan, and then they've sent spies and army units all the way up to Bashan to conquer this whole area. Pretty fascinating.
Just so they can get into Israel.
You know, that's a good point. They don't need to conquer the Bashan to get into the land of Israel.
It doesn't seem like it.
They don't at all. And it doesn't say why they did that. If you remember the story from the book, later from the end of the book of Numbers and from the book of Joshua, it ends up that 2.5 tribes, remember, stay on this side of the Jordan and don't go over. So this whole area becomes not part of Canaan, but part of the Israelite territory, even though it's on the other side, the eastern side of the Jordan Valley. And here's the first mention of a conquest there. And all this, of course, is before they actually cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan proper.
So were there a lot of cities on that side?
Say it again?
Were there a lot of cities on that side? Was it a commercial route? Or what I'm thinking is that they were trying to establish as much space alone to other, so that they would not have other people come. So they were trying to isolate it.
Yeah, buffer zone.
Like a barrier.
So I don't know. I know that they had asked to go through the Derech HaMelech, the king's path, through Edom, and they weren't allowed, so they had to go all the way on a loop on the side. They got here, and there's mention of a few kings that they conquered. We don't have any archaeological evidence or historical evidence of actually what went on.
Where is the actual border that was prescribed earlier, where God says not to go beyond this, that, and the other?
Not to go beyond, but yeah, the border of Canaan.
This is the border, yeah.
The border of Canaan is here. Right? The tribes, the 2.5 tribes that end up settling later in the book of Numbers in the area to the east of the Jordan that's conquered right now, they're not in the land of Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in the land of Canaan. That's an overview. Now we can start talking about, is there anything to learn from this? Anything meaningful? So, I'm going on the sheets to the second sheet. I see it didn't print on both sides of the sheet, unfortunately. The second sheet, the middle of the sheet, is D. Has anything changed after 40 years? That's the question I want to spend actually the whole rest of the class on. Has anything changed? God punished the people after the sin of the spies, 40 years in the desert, so that evil generation will die out and a new generation can enter the land. But the question is the new generation any better than the old generation? Well, we already saw briefly in the past 10 minutes when I did this kind of survey that this new generation, and I'm assuming it's a new generation because we said 40 years have passed, they've reached Kadesh where they were 40 years ago about to go into land. 40 years have passed, it's a new generation, the whole old generation died out, but in the brief survey we saw that the people complained, just like they did in the past. They complained that they had no water, that's in chapter 20, when that's the whole matter of Moses hitting the rock and being punished. And they complained about the man, were sick of this food, and that's where they were punished by being being bitten by the serpents that we briefly saw. So at first glance, it doesn't look like this new generation, this younger generation, is any better than the old generation. What I want to do is look closely at the verses so that we can detect indeed a certain maturation process, a certain difference. That's the point. So looking at the sheets I prepared, we want to focus in D1, A and B, on these two complaints that look at first blush as bad as all the other complaints that their fathers and their mothers participated in. So I'm chapter 20, verses 2 to 5. Chapter 20, verses 2 to 5. The community was without water, and they joined against Moshe and Aaron. The people quarreled with Moshe, saying, "If only we had perished when our brothers perished at the instance of the Lord. Why have you brought the Lord's congregation into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die there? Why did you make us leave Egypt to bring us to this wretched place, a place with no grain or figs or vines or pomegranates? There is not even water to drink." Sounds pretty bad, just like their fathers. And the other complaint that we just saw briefly, chapter 21, verses 4 to 6, we'll read that also now, even though we read it 5 minutes ago. Just read it again. 21, 4 to 6. They set out from Mount Hor by way of the Sea of Reeds, we said that's the Red Sea, Eilat, to skirt the land of Edom. But the people grew restive on the journey, which means enough of this, right? And the people spoke against God and against Moshe, "Why did you make us leave Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no bread and no water, and we have come to loathe this miserable food," the man. Again, another complaint that seems pretty bad. So, look at the sheet I prepared in D2. In italics, I brought a midrash that looks rather interesting. The midrash says the following in italics. "And God distinguished between the light and the darkness." That's from the beginning of the Torah, Bereishit, Genesis. Say the rabbis, this alludes to Sefer Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, which distinguishes between the generation that left Egypt and those who entered the land. And you ask yourself, wait a second, I didn't see that the book of Numbers distinguished. It seems to treat the new generation just like the old one. These were complainers and these are complainers. These revolt and these revolt. So I want to try and figure out what is the difference between the two generations. Has anything progressed? And where can we see in the text certain subtle differences? So if we're looking at the first complaint in chapter 20 about the water, we have to compare it to an almost identical event that happened 40 years ago, which is in the book of Exodus. I don't know if Gail talked about the parallel between these two complaints about water, but if we hold our fingers here in chapter 20 and we go now back to Shemot, to Exodus 17, 1-4, we'll see that the younger generation is repeating the sins of their fathers, but with a difference. But with a difference. And this is going to be an important difference. So we're back in Exodus. So look at chapter 17, verses 1-4. And let's read carefully. I'll wait for everyone to find the place because we really have to compare this meticulously. 17, 1-4. "From the wilderness of Tzin," I'm sorry, Tzin, it's a different spelling. It's a different place. It's not Tzin, it's Tzin. "The whole Israelite community continued by stages as the Lord would command." They just left Egypt. They didn't even get to Mount Sinai yet. "They encamped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. The people quarreled with Moshe. 'Give us water to drink,' they said. And Moses replied to them, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you try the Lord?' But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, 'Why did you bring us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?'" That's all. "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So I want to ask that everyone take 3 minutes to read to themselves again these three verses and compare them to the verses in chapter 20 of the book of Numbers, the quarrel of the people against Moses and Aaron in verses 3 and 4 and 5 and see if you can find the difference. And perhaps you'll disagree with me. Perhaps you say there's no difference. A difference that shows some progress, some moral, spiritual, emotional progress.
Well,
wait a second. I want everyone to think another minute. Sorry, I cut you off. So anyone besides Leslie have a suggestion?
I don't know if this makes you thirsty. Yeah. Get some water.
He said that's making you thirsty.
Our suggestion.
Well, they stopped saying, it sounds like they're very similar, but they stopped saying, why did you bring it to kill us? They don't seem to think that they were brought there to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still complaining about the bread, the water, and why did you take
it? So that's a good point that they don't mention that, being killed in the desert. What else?
In the second instance, they're identifying themselves as the people of Hashem. They're more identified with God.
Oh, that's a good point. The Lord's congregation. Look at that. That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a certain self-respect. They know their relationship to God. That's a very good point. I hadn't even noticed that. But that's certainly true. Two good points so far. Anything else?
So what I was going to say is in 17, it looks like, you know, the people quarreled just with Moses. And in 20. Never mind. I was in the wrong spot.
Okay, Jerry?
In the first one, the people are demanding water. They mm-hmm. say, give us water.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second one, they're pointing to the fact that they don't have it, but they're not doing it in the same fashion.
Aha, uh-huh, okay. That's good also, another good point.
I also mentioned the word brothers, which hadn't been mentioned before.
Brothers, I'm trying to see.
Chapter 20 in Numbers, they talk about one arm.
I see, you have a different translation than me, right?
No, it should be the same.
Yeah, they refer to children in the second
chapter 20, verse 3.
Verse 3. Oh, you're right, I'm sorry. If only we had perish where our brothers perished the entrance of the Lord.
So you see good. Some connectedness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. That's good.
They talk about brothers and cattle in the first one, but in this chapter 17, they talk about children and cattle.
Mm-hmm. Right, so the one in Numbers is referring back. Right. Okay. Good. So there's something that no one pointed out, which is an additional statement that's found in Numbers that's not found in Exodus, which we should analyze. So I'm looking at Numbers, where it says in chapter 20, verse 5, why did you make us leave Egypt to bring us to this wretched place, a place with no grain or figs or vines or pomegranates? When they say grain, fig, vines, pomegranates, right, they're talking about the fruits of the land of Israel, which means they have Israel on their mind, which means they have the goal on their mind. So I'd like to make the following suggestion. In the complaint in chapter 17 of the book of Exodus, they're looking backwards. In the complaint in the book of Numbers, they're looking forward. Now let's look at that again. Let's see if you accept what I'm suggesting. In chapter 17, I'm going to read again, verse 3. Why did you bring us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Which I think means, the subtext is, we want to go back. And we've seen them say that explicitly in many other places. We want to go back. Whereas, in the book of Numbers, in chapter 20, it says, 4, Why have you brought the Lord's congregation in this wilderness for us and our beasts to die there? Why did you make us leave Egypt to bring us to this wretched place, a place with no grain or fig or vine or pomegranate? Which means, subtext, why did you take us out of Egypt without bringing us into the land of Israel? That's what they're saying. In other words, they're complaining that we haven't yet reached our goal. So to put it in other words, in the book of Exodus, why did we leave Egypt? That's the problem. In the book of Numbers, the problem is, why didn't we get there yet? They're looking forward. They're immature for certain, and they're impatient for certain, but they're looking forward. They're no longer talking about going back to Egypt, which makes sense because 40 years have passed, and they're a new generation.
Still disgruntled.
Still disgruntled, right? They have a lot to learn.
Yeah, but Moshe's response to them is also extremely different, because in the first one, he's saying, what will I do with this people? They're going to stone me.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second one, he and Aaron have gone to pray to the tent of meeting, and they're coming back, and God is telling them, but they're not, Moses and Aaron aren't responding to the anger of the people.
Yes, and that's a different story, but the question is that good or bad? There is those who would say that in the book of Numbers we see that Moses and Aaron have already fed up. They have no response. They're tired of this complaining. They would have expected the new generation would behave better. They're a little bit better, but not enough to justify all the work we put into it. So, that's number one. And I don't think that I've proven the point, but it's plausible, what we just suggested. Now let's go on. I'm turning in my sheet of paper here to the top of the third piece of paper, B, which says, let's compare everything we're learning now to Korach's rebellion in the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, chapter 16, verses 12 and 14. And even though chapter 16 is only a few chapters before chapter 20, it could be 38 years earlier. So we're looking at Korach's rebellion in chapter 16 of Numbers, verses 12 to 14, which say as follows. 16, verse 12. Moses sent for Datan and Aviram, sons of Eliab, but they said, we will not come. Is it not enough that you have brought us from a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, that you would also lord it over us? The next verse, the translation is really not clear. I'll read it the following way. You have not even brought us to a land flowing with milk and honey and given us possessions of fields and vineyards. Should you gouge out these men's eyes, we will not come. Here, if you look clearly, Datan and Aviram are derisively making fun of the promise of a land of milk and honey. They say, is it not enough that you have brought us from a land of milk and honey? In other words, they're saying, Egypt was the promised land. It was a land of milk and honey. You brought us into the desert. So they're aware of Moses' and God's promise to bring them into a land of milk and honey, but they're derisively making fun of it. They're still looking back. And that is, again, so different from what we find in the next generation in chapter 20, when they're not only aware of the promise, they're looking forward to it, and their problem is, are we there yet? That's the problem. Okay. Now let's look at the other complaint of the new generation in chapter 21 of the book of Numbers. That's not the complaint that's primarily about water, it's primarily about food, about bread. In chapter 21, verses 1 to 4 that we saw already, I'll just read quickly. Chapter 21, the Canaanite king of Arad dwelt in the Negev, learned that Israel coming by the way of the Atarim. He engaged Israel in battle, took some of them captive. Then Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, you deliver this people into our hand, we will prescribe their towns. Lord heeded Israel's plea and delivered up the Canaanites, and named their cities were prescribed, so the place was called Hormah. They set out from Mount Hor by the way of the seed of reeds to skirt the land of Edom. They start going south, remember? But the people grew restive on the journey, and the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why? did you make us leave Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no bread and no water, and we have come to loathe this miserable food. So, I want to point out two factors. One is the end of verse 4, but the people grew restive on the journey. Their problem is with the journey. And the end of verse 5, we have come to loathe this miserable food. We're fed up with it. I'll make a suggestion. It's plausible but not proven. Their problem is the journey is taking too long. We're fed up with this manna. We've had it for too long. We're expecting already something else, and it's not coming. They're not looking back to go back to Egypt. They're saying, why did you take us out of Egypt when we're just journeying and journeying and journeying? We have to eat this food all the time. We're never getting anywhere. It's not that they want to go back. It's that they want to, again, get where they're going. That's possible, but I can't prove that in the words. But now I want to point out something that relates to the geography we talked about earlier, and I hope things will come together. Remember, as we just saw a minute ago, this complaint comes after they conquer and vanquish the king of Arad. But instead of moving north into the land of Israel, for some strange reason, they go south. So I would suggest that that explains the genesis of the complaint. Going from Kadesh Barnea, moving north, conquering the king of Arad, and suddenly Moses says, we're going back south. And they say, wait a second, we're almost there. Why don't we go forward? We're sick of this manna. In other words, if we would have gone forward another 3 or 4 days, we could stop eating the manna and eat real food. Why you bring us back in the opposite direction? So it's possible this complaint is generated by the real desire to get to the goal already. It's not a complaint, we want to go back to Egypt. It's a complaint, we want to get to the land of Israel. We're just about there, and suddenly you're sending us backward. It's not fair. They're not saying it's not fair that you took us out of Egypt. Rather, they're saying it's not fair that you're not bringing us into the land that God promised. And if that's a plausible reading, and I think it's a plausible reading, then it again shows us that this generation is somewhat different than their parents, because they're looking forward as opposed to looking backward. Now let me add something to that. They were just at a place called Chorma, where they defeated the Canaanites from Arad. We've heard that place before. We've heard that place before. So what we have to do now is hold our fingers where we are now and go back to what's called the Mapilim. The Mapilim was that group of people that after God told the Israelites, you can't go into the land because you followed the spies and you revolted against my promise, 40 years in the desert, God said, they said, no, we changed our minds, we're going into the land. But God says it's too late. And they tried to go into the land and they were defeated by the Canaanites at a place called Chorma. Let's look at that. So it is in chapter 14, verse 39. Chapter 14, verse 39. We're using this word chorma as kind of a bridge, as a hint to look back at these verses in the aftermath of the sin of the spies. Chapter 14, verse 39. When Moses repeated these words to all the Israelites, that God punishes you, you can't go into land, the people were overcome by grief. Early next morning, they set out towards the crest of the hill country, saying, we are prepared to go up to the place that the Lord has spoken of, for we were wrong. But Moses said, why do you transgress the Lord's command? This will not succeed, because God already said, you can't go, it's too late, you missed your chance. Do not go up, lest you be routed by your enemies. For the Lord is not in your midst, for the Amalekites and the Canaanites will be there to face you, and will fall, and you will fall by the sword, inasmuch as you have turned from following the Lord, and the Lord will not be with you. Yet defiantly they marched toward the crest of the hill country, though the Lord's Ark of the Covenant nor Moses stirred from the camp. And the Amalekites and the Canaanites who dwelt in the hill country came down and dealt them a shattering blow at Chorma. That's the same Chorma that we're talking about in chapter 21. So I want to make the following suggestion, that word chorma is being used in chapter 21 as a flashback to 39, 40 years ago. What happened 39, 40 years ago? The people in Kadesh Barnea, and they sent out the spies. The people revolted against God, didn't want to go into the land. And then they tried anyway when it was too late, and they were defeated at Horma. So Horma reminds them that they tried to go into the land, but it was too late, and they were stopped. So now, fast forward to the next generation. They're at Kadesh Barnea, the same place that their fathers were 40 years ago. And they move forward towards Arad. But this time they're doing it not against God's will, but they're doing it as they're supposed to. And they're successful. And after they defeat the king of Arad, for some reason Moses sends them back south. And they say to themselves, it's Chorma again. It's deja vu. Our forefathers revolted against God and were punished by being sent back south. We didn't revolt against God. We did what we were supposed to do. We went forward north, but we're again being punished by being told to go south again. It's Chorma a second time. And the people say, it's not fair. They complain against Moses. Moses, we want to get there already. The point I'm trying to make is, if we understand what the people remember from their fathers and mothers, then at this point, they expect history to be different. Because now we're following God's will. We've gone due north. We did what we're supposed to. We were successful. But we're being punished. Just like our forefathers were punished. But our forefathers did wrong. We did right. What's going on? Moses sends them south. And they say, Moses, it's not fair. That's the complaint. So the point is that the complaint, again, is very, very different than the complaint of their parents. They feel that they want to go into the land. They deserve to go into the land. They did the right thing, but they're being sent south again. They're not told why. And that's why they revolt. So again, of course, they're immature. They should obey, or they should ask what's happening. They shouldn't just lash out in this childish fashion. They deserve to be punished. But it's a different kind of complaint than what their fathers and mothers did 40 years ago. It's a complaint that shows a certain degree of desire to fulfill the will of God and to go into the land of Israel. That's my suggestion. Let me see what time it is. Anyone want to stop me?
They get punished nonetheless.
They get punished, right? They shouldn't be revolting.
No, I mean, that's what strikes me is that it's easily understand where they're coming from. But
right.
It doesn't even matter whether it's justified or not, whether their complaint is justified or not. I'm not saying it is.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they get...
Yeah.
God sends the serpents.
So they're still immature. They're still rather disrespectful, disobedient. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm trying to make some sense of our material. So, I want to make a few more points. Let me look at my sheet. How are we doing? Good, good, good. Okay, yeah. Let's look here in chapter 21, verse 4b to 7, which we've been reading. We didn't read after the complaint and after the punishment, we didn't yet read verse 7. The same place we've been. And this verse 7 is going to show us another point in which these people are perhaps a little bit better, have learned a little bit over and above what their parents knew. Verse 7 says, the people came to Moshe and said, we sinned by speaking against the Lord and against us. Excuse me, against you. Intercede with the Lord to take away the serpents from us. Well, believe it or not, guys, that's almost the first place that the Israelites mention any type of contrition. They say, we've sinned. That's an accomplishment. There's a certain degree of taking responsibility, a certain degree of self-reflection. And again, their parents and all the complaints and all the punishments that took place earlier never said those words, never said, we made a mistake, we're sorry, we sinned. Now, I have to correct myself. Their parents did say it once, but when you see the context, you'll see that it's meaningless. The one place that their parents did say we sinned, we actually just read 5 minutes ago. So let's hold our fingers here and go back there to chapter 14. Was it chapter 14?
Yeah.
Yes. Right, chapter 14, verse 40. Chapter 14, verse 40. Early next morning, in the book of Numbers. This is again after they're told by Moses, you can't enter the land because you sinned in the matter of the spies. Early next morning, they set out towards the crest of the hill country, saying, we are prepared to go up to the place the Lord has spoken of, for we were wrong. So they sinned. They sinned and they say, we're wrong. But it's while they're saying that we're going to sin again. They were told, you can't go into land. And they say, we're going anyway, because we sinned. But they're using their contrition as a foundation to actually go against exactly what they've been told. So although they say they were wrong, we sinned, it really didn't sink in, clearly, because they're doing exactly what they're not supposed to do, and they're punished again. As we read in verse 44 and 45, that the Canaanites come and defeat them. So they're the parents of the new generation, only once did they say we were wrong, and even then when they said it, they really didn't mean what they were saying. Whereas the next generation here, right after they are punished with the serpents, actually do make a statement of contrition. And it could be that's another sign that there is progress that's been made. There is a certain level of taking responsibility that has that the people have progressed to. That's my suggestion. Okay, one last point. One last point. And that is on the sheet here, at the bottom of the sheet we've been looking at. It says E. I want to examine something we skipped over in chapter 20-21. Now we'll read it. I'm talking about the song. This song begins, let's look at verse 16 in chapter 21. Chapter 21, verse 16. And from there to Be'er, which is the well where the Lord said to Moses, assemble the people that I may give them water. Then Israel sang this song. And it gives us the song, the poem that they wrote and sang. Spring up, O well, sing to it. The well which the chieftains dug, which the nobles of the people started, with maces with their own staffs. End of the song. So here you have a song, a poem, that celebrates and gives thanksgiving for something related to water. Now there's one other place in the Torah where the Israelites sing about a miracle of water. Where? What?
Parting of
the Red Sea. And we want to compare the content and the tenor of the song at the parting of the Red Sea to this song about water, this song about thanksgiving. And the point is as follows. In the splitting of the Red Sea, and in the song about the splitting of the Red Sea, the people give thanks to God. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We're very, very appreciative. It's all about what God did for us. And if you remember the story of the splitting of the Red Sea, it emphasizes human passivity. Moses says, you guys stand by and see the salvation of the Lord. And all they have to do is walk through the sea and they're saved. But if we read again this song, it doesn't only praise God and emphasize human passivity, but rather, spring up a well, sing to it the well which the chieftains dug, which the nobles of the people started with maces with their own staffs. In other words, they're giving praise to God at the same time that it seems from the song they put some effort into this. In other words, this might be one of the few places in the journey through the desert in which we see some type of divine human partnership. That's new. That's new. Throughout the desert, they have been passive. God has been in control completely. Here we see that they're taking some initiative. Perhaps, can't be certain, perhaps that's another sign that the new generation has something going for them. They've learned something. A certain degree of responsibility. Again, this is all conjecture.
Well, the passing from being slave to being, you know, when you're a slave, you're always being told what to do, how to do it. You don't have to think about it.
Exactly. And
the first generation couldn't get past that.
Right. I've given more than one class in which I said that the exodus from Egypt is not only about taking Israel out of Egypt, it's about taking Egypt out of Israel.
I remember that.
Right, and it was not so successful. Because that first generation, when everything goes wrong, they want to go back to the cocoon of Egypt where they got all their needs taken care of, right? They were slaves, okay, but they didn't have to take any responsibility. And in the desert, they don't learn to take responsibility, and the best that can be done is to teach them to rely on God in place of relying upon Paro, but they can only rely on someone and something else. They don't learn any responsibility. And apparently, God and Moses decide it's not worth teaching them any responsibility. They're still slaves. If not physically, they're certainly slaves mentally and spiritually and emotionally. This might be one of the first points at which we see some type of human initiative, certain amount of picking themselves up by their own bootstraps. And all I want to do is emphasize that there are a few more of such points right here in chapter 20 and 21 that might be meaningful. So it goes like this. In chapter 20, verse 14, chapter 20, verse 14, we're in the new generation, as we discussed, but we still see passivity. I have to admit, we still see passivity from Kadesh. Moses sent messages to the king of Edom. And remember, the story said, we want to go through your land, we won't take anything, we won't cause any problems, let us pass through. And the answer is given in verse 18, but Edom answered him, you shall not pass through, else we will go out against you with the sword. And the Israelites say, please, please, please. And the Edomites say, no, no, no. And what happens in the end, verse 20, so Edom would not let Israel cross their territory, and Israel turned away from them. Passivity. Not willing to challenge the Edomites. But from that point on, it all changes. In chapter 21, the battle against the king of Arad, as we saw a few minutes ago, they take the initiative. They're challenged. Captives are taken. They vow, we're going to attack. We're going to counterattack. And they do. And then, let's look at another initiative. We talked about the well. And now we get to verse 21 of chapter 21. 21:21. Israel now sent messages to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, let me pass through this country. Right, they want to continue, they want to pass through. And the Amorites say no. But this time, the Israelite reaction is not to turn away, it's to face the Amorites in battle. Verse 24, but Israel put them to the sword. And this initiative continues in verse 31. So Israel occupied the land of the Amorites, then Moses sent to spy out Yazer, and they captured its dependencies, disposed the Amorites who were there. Verse 33, then they marched on and went up to the road to Bashan, and King Og of Bashan with all his people came out to Edrei to engage them in battle. But the Lord said to Moses, do not fear him, for I give him and all his people and his land into your hand. You shall do to him as you did to the Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon. They defeated him and his sons and all his people until no remnant was left, and they took possession of his country. Suddenly the Israelites are so militaristic. They're so active. They're so unafraid. It's a big change. If you remember, when they first came out of Egypt 40 years ago, it said God didn't lead them by way of the Philistines because God was afraid they would see war and turn back to Egypt. Things have changed. So to sum up, I tried to show that even though this new generation is not at the pinnacle of spirituality and responsibility, there are some changes that have happened. They're willing to take initiative. They're not looking backwards or looking forwards. They're complaining indeed, but at least they're complaining that we haven't gotten there yet. They want to get to the land of Israel. They're on board with God's project of bringing them into the land. They just don't know exactly how to do that, and they're willing to take some initiative. That's the story. And when we finish the verse we just read, the end of chapter 22, just let me read this one verse and this will end. It's actually the first verse of the next chapter. The Israelites then marched on and encamped in the steppes of Moab across the Jordan from Jericho. Do you see that verse? Which means that right now, in a geographical sense, the Torah has come to an end. It's at the same point right here that they're encamped, and for the rest of the book of Numbers, that's where they stay. The whole book of Deuteronomy, that's where they stay. And then the book of Joshua opens up with them crossing over the Jordan at this point. So in other words, from a geographical point of view, the Torah is now over. We have gotten to where we're going to get. That's the story. Any questions, comments?
We've gotten as far as we want to get. Are going to get under Moses's
right, right, right. If the question was, "Are we there yet?" We're there.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Sit again, please.
This was very different in the way we learned it.
I'd like to sit in the class with Gail and learn it in a different fashion.
Yeah.